Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance here at Texas A&M. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I am so glad that you took the time to download us and that you're listening today. Every week, we strive to bring you interesting people from the world of sports medicine and health in general. And today is no exception, as I say every week, because we have amazing people that agree to talk to us, and we're so pleased with that. But we have Dr. Lasako Makayer with us today. Lasako, welcome to the podcast.
Hello and howdy, and thank you for having me here.
Excellent. Well, that's an enthusiastic hello. I like that. Yeah. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you,
okay. And
then we'll just jump into the conversation. Dr. Makayer has a PhD in health behavior. She also has an MPH in community health. And Dr. Makayer had the honor of being the first diverse woman to earn the degree in the Department of Applied Health Sciences at Indiana University. And you'll find out why I said diverse woman a little bit later. She created and oversees the Child and Adolescent Health Research Lab at Texas A&M University. She's the director also of the Transdisciplinary Center for Health Equity Research in the Department of Health and Kinesiology here. And also, as many academics do, she wears multiple hats. She's the associate director for the Institute for Obesity Research and Program Evaluation here. Again, welcome. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
Let's just start with this.
Okay.
Why don't we just start with the easy question?
Which is?
Well, we said you were a woman of diverse background.
Yes.
Tell us, what is your diverse background and how that brought you to what you're doing now?
Well,
or if it did.
I guess partially.
Yeah.
I was born and raised in Japan, and my mother is a native Japanese woman, and my father is African American.
Okay.
So I guess I'm Afro-Asian.
Afro-Asian. Oh,
yeah,
I like that.
There we go. And the interesting part is I was born there and I lived there during my formative years, and moved to the U.S. when I was it was 2 months before my 12th birthday. And when I arrived, the only time I had spoken English was at school in Japan, because at home and with my friends, we spoke Japanese.
Oh, really?
So I arrived here in the U.S. with a very heavy accent. So people would hear me, and they would turn around and look for a little Asian girl, and they see this little black girl and kind of get confused. And also, my mother's family is of noble lineage.
Really?
So we can trace my family tree back about almost 800 years.
Wow.
Going back to our founding ancestor, her name was Motoori Hime, which means Princess Motoori. So when my six-year-old daughter says she's Princess Jada, she is technically correct.
Well, I was going to say, so should we call you Princess Dr.
You
Lasako
call me
Makayer?
Your Highness.
Your
no,
Highness.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay. See, folks listening, you didn't know that we were going to interview nobility today. I didn't either. I'm impressed.
Well, thank you.
Well, I think now we have to be more circumspect as we ask Lasako questions, don't we? So tell us how you got into what you're doing, because your interesting background didn't end there.
No. Okay. So I have the dubious distinction of enrolling in college in 1984, actually fall of 1983, and flunking out.
Oh.
Which was...
And your life ended at the time.
You know, you would have thought, and that's certainly how I felt when that happened. But you learn a lot from failures, quite honestly. Neither one of my parents went to college, so we didn't know what the experience was supposed to be like or even how to apply. So when I finally went out into the world and I became trained as a decorating consultant and a kitchen and bath designer.
Okay.
And I did that for several years. I had clients. Most of my clients ended up being part of the Los Angeles Raiders football team, which was interesting. Yeah. And I started my own business with some friends of mine. We started an educational children's toy store. And for those who are familiar with the Bryan-College Station area, there's a store called Jackie's that's near Luby's, and it was similar to that. what happened was I started working closely with many schools and PTAs, and the conversation inevitably got around to, where did you go to school? And I didn't have an answer.
Oh.
And I was embarrassed at not having an answer. So at age 26, I went back to school. And I went to Santa Monica College first as a community college, transferred to Cal State Northridge. And at that time, I was taken under the wing of a faculty member who, for some reason, saw something and gave me a break. She let me be her TA as an undergraduate.
Wow.
And she heard about a training grant that was available through the National Institutes of Health.
Hmm.
And she literally walked me over to the PI and said, take her and train her. And that completely changed the trajectory of my life.
Wow.
So I was funded for 2 years as an undergraduate, NIGMS scholar, and did research with pediatric populations, kids who had either chronic or terminal diseases and physical disabilities, like osteogenesis imperfecta or brittle bone disease, diabetes, whatever, lupus, and worked with understanding how their parents and social networks sort of helped them transition into adulthood. And that piqued my interest in child health.
Now, before you go on, though, I'm going to interrupt you and stop. Because what I want to stop and give a mini take-home message for people, and that is that so many students in particular that may be listening think that their life is over if they do poorly in a semester. And you really can speak to that's not the case.
Oh, no. When I hear people, when my students come in, my undergraduates say, I'm going to be a fifth-year senior. And like, really? Oh, it's the worst thing that can happen. Well, you know, I didn't get that memo.
Yeah.
And it hasn't hurt me. It may have taken me on a route that I had not anticipated.
Right.
But I'm where I'm supposed to be, and I think I'm stronger and better for it. So failure is not a bad thing.
Well, and your story also comes back to the fact it's never too late.
That's the wonderful thing. Okay, there's many things wrong with this country, but there's a lot of things right. And this place is full of chances for second, third, and fourth chances if you can find a way to do it and get the help.
Right.
And in many countries, once you lose that opportunity to go to get a college education after high school, you've lost it. There is no coming back.
Right. And your story also illustrates, you know, people talk a lot about what's wrong with the university system in the country. We still have a tremendous number of foreign nationals that come to go to school here because it is one of the better institutions of higher education in general. But it also illustrates that there are a lot of caring faculty out there. And, I mean, your story in particular talks about one faculty member who said, hey, I'm going to help you out.
And she is my mentor to this day, Joyce Brodsky, who introduced me to Carrie Sadamo. And I'm working on a grant proposal with Carrie Sadamo right now. So it's amazing. You know, we come full circle.
Sure.
And I'm just in awe at the helping hands that are out there by faculty.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go back and talk about children's health, because that's really where you got funneled into.
Yes.
And you really have a passion for that.
I do. So I enrolled in the clinical psychology program at Indiana University, and it's a wonderful program, top five in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And my specialty was pediatric psychology. So I work with kids, again, who had chronic diseases. And in this case, I worked mostly with kids who had cystic fibrosis. I also spent considerable time at Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis doing my practica.
Mm-hmm.
The most difficult part was seeing sick children and those who are unable to recover for whatever reasons, or also seeing kids who were there because of things that other people had done to them.
Mm.
And I realized that the clinical treatment part was really difficult for me. It just took too much out of me. Mm. And I am just amazed at the health professionals who can work in that kind of a setting, because I know how emotionally taxing it is. So I remember one day driving home after I found out that one child did not have an organ transplant that they needed. And I cried all the way home. And at that point, I decided I didn't want to do this anymore. I want to do something preventive.
Right.
So that's how I got into child health promotion.
You know, a lot of people don't know that I have a degree in counseling. And I decided not to go into counseling because I couldn't handle the emotional burden of that, or what I would consider an emotional burden, because I knew I wouldn't be able to leave that at the office. And so I can certainly sympathize with what you're saying. That must be very difficult to see that on a daily basis.
Especially with children.
Yeah.
You know, they can't do anything.
Yeah. So tell us, how did you take that and morph into the prevention side of things?
Well, at the time I finished all my coursework for the clinical psych degree and my hours, and I was minoring in public health. And at that time, I flip-flopped. Hmm. So I majored in public health and health behavior and minored in psych. And I also failed my first stats class in grad school, another failure.
Yeah. and that's not an unfamiliar failure for grad school. Statistics seems to be an ugly thing for
people. It was humiliating for me, and I was so angry at myself for that I ended up finishing with a stats minor.
There you go.
Go figure.
And you want to prove them wrong.
Yeah. I do know something about a mean.
That's right.
and so with my switch to the health behavior program, I was involved in a state block grant where we looked at alcohol, tobacco, and drug prevention throughout the state of Indiana. It was a state-funded project, and I was the director of the survey, the annual survey. Hmm. Here at A&M, it's done out of PPRI, but we ran the shop at Indiana, and I loved it. I loved being able to get data that would help me highlight what is going on, what works, what doesn't work, so that I could turn around and give it back to the people who are in the trenches so that they may make programmatic or policy changes. So that's what I call impact.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's how I ended up in health. And then I moved to Texas, and here I am.
And here you are. Let's take a real broad question to start with. Do prevention efforts in general work? We see, you know, in some fields in particular, some physicians now, they say, well, we don't recommend exercise and good diet anymore because people aren't going to do it.
Okay.
And we'd prefer to give them drugs. So there is this, in some senses, some areas of the medical community, there's this idea that prevention efforts don't work because people are too lazy to change their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So do they work?
They do work.
Okay.
So it's analogous to like your retirement plan.
Yeah.
If you wait until you're 50 and broke,
yeah,
and want to have enough to live off of when you're 65 or 70, you're going to have to put a whole lot more into it. Now, changing behaviors is extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And maintaining changed behaviors as an adult is also difficult. But at some point, it becomes your new behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So relapsing would become difficult. For example, seatbelt use.
Right.
Once you've gotten used to the feel of a seatbelt, if you try driving without it, you sort of sometimes feel like
weird.
You feel weird. So now your new behavior is permanent, and it requires quite a bit of intervention to do it the other way. Now, for prevention, particularly with children, if you intervene early enough, there's no behavior to change, right? You've tracked the beneficial behavior on the big end, on the front end, and so in the long run, the payoff is there, sort of like starting your retirement plan when you're 5 instead of when you're 50.
Right.
The payoffs are great. And what I know it sounds strange to sort of put it this way, but in my opinion, doing prevention with children means that if I do my job right, nothing happens.
They don't get sick.
Right.
Right. So, but that's also a good health outcome.
Exactly.
I mean, that's something that's measurable.
Exactly.
Right.
Which is why many other developed nations put so much of their money into health promotion and prevention programs rather than on the treatment side like we tend to do here in the U.S.
Right. Yeah. So where do we go from here? I mean, so as a country, I'm going to ask you about the 30,000-foot view. How do we get out of this treating sickness model and move towards a prevention model? I mean, that's a question that I've heard over the last 25 years.
Yeah.
And, so how do we get there?
Well, okay, there's the relatively easy way, which is not what I would advocate, and that's policy changes.
Right.
You can legislate your way to forcing people to behave the way they should.
Such as cutting down the big Cokes in New York City.
Right.
The big sodas, I should say.
But we really don't want to do that. What you really want to do is set up our system, the way we live, in a way that makes doing the healthy thing the easier option.
Right.
It shouldn't be easier to find a candy bar than it is to find fresh grapes.
Hmm.
it shouldn't be harder to find a bottle of water than it is to find a 20-ounce Coke.
Right.
It shouldn't be harder to walk to school than it is to drive two blocks to school.
And it's amazing that the unhealthy choices like the soda and the candy bar are usually less expensive than the water and the grapes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the example that I give to some of my students when I talk to them about this is, if you're feeding a family of five and you only have $5, what are you going to spend it on?
Right.
You need to make a decision. Are you going to go calorie dense, which means hot dogs and, you know, the pseudo cheese and all those fatty things that will keep your kids from complaining about their hunger? Or are you going to buy that bag of apples?
Right.
And they'll be asking for another one in an hour and you've run out. So that's a difficult decision to make. We need to set things up so that the better choice is the easier one, so that we do it by default.
Mm-hmm. How do we do that, though?
How do we do that?
Because that's not, our society hasn't moved that way. Our society has moved towards what we'll just call fast food. In, out, you get it, and it's oftentimes not the best food, but it's also the cheapest.
Yes. Actually, I think I'm seeing signs of improvement in those areas. Mm. You know, when you go to fast food restaurants, you now see options. Instead of french fries, you can have apples, or you're going to get apples no matter what, and you have to ask for the french fries.
Yeah.
But also, it requires a lifestyle change, and the amount of work Americans put in, for example, hours of work, is there a way that we can scale things back so that the family time and leisure time, which is important to your overall health, is valued, and that you can take advantage of it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So we all need time to decompress.
Sure.
So we just, you know, maybe need to lower our unreasonable expectations for ourselves and make them more reasonable.
We've had past guests who have said if the only thing we could do was bring back family dinners,
mm-hmm.
that would solve so many things.
So many. Juvenile delinquency.
Yeah.
You know, even our eating habits. Yeah, you're right. That would make a tremendous difference.
So you're the director of the Transdisciplinary Center for Health Equity Research.
Yes, sir.
So tell us a little bit about that. That's under kind of the general umbrella of health disparities research.
Yes.
So tell the audience a little bit about what that encompasses.
Okay. Well, what we see in the U.S. are disparities in health outcomes which are modifiable. There are some health disparities that can't be changed. Mm-hmm. For example, the rate of cystic fibrosis in whites is higher than it is in other racial ethnic groups. And there's nothing we can do that's going to change that.
That's genetic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. But there are health outcomes which are attributable to factors that are modifiable.
Hmm.
We can change them, such as reduction of breast cancer by making sure that every woman has the access and ability to get screened,
mm-hmm.
and tested. Prostate cancer screenings for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Access to environments where you can engage in physical activities. There are some places where you don't want to send your children outside,
right.
so they can't play.
Right.
Which means that you've got an inactive group of kids who end up with health problems down the line.
Right.
So that's what health disparities are. And what we want to do at the TEACHER, by the way, is, that's the acronym, is to understand what better the mechanisms of those modifiable determinants, the things that we can change so that we can change them.
Mm-hmm.
But we also understand that from a study perspective, one discipline doesn't have the answer.
Right.
For example, when it comes to obesity, we need to know something about policy. So you need people who understand policy.
Mm-hmm.
Built environments, the architects and the urban planners who design streets and sidewalks. We need to know about nutrition, not just the microchemicals that go into foods, but also feeding practices. Mm. So that's two other disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
Psychology,
mm-hmm.
right? All of these disciplines together, transdisciplinary, can work together to try to understand the problem,
mm-hmm.
so that we can come up with solutions that are workable. So that's what our center is about, is pulling together people who are interested in a common area and learn from each other's perspective or what do you call it? Sorry. Relative areas of expertise.
Sure.
and build our knowledge base.
And we're really not talking, you're not talking about just issues that are different between ethnicities or races.
No.
You're talking about also socioeconomic
Absolutely.
Issues as well. And that, unfortunately, cuts across all
Right.
ethnicities and
Right. And
races.
So, for example, drug use, drugs such as heroin, the hard drugs, use of that is highest among rich white children or rich white teens.
Mm.
Why is that?
Right.
That shouldn't happen.
Right.
I mean, quite frankly, it shouldn't happen for anyone, but that there's a disparity there is a
yeah.
problem.
Yeah.
We have rural, urban, suburban disparities, right? And then we have educational disparities. And so what I like about our center is that we're in the College of Education and we're the only one in the country that is in a College of Ed. The reason is if you look closely at all the countries in the world,
mm-hmm.
there is an incredibly strong correlation between educational disparities and health disparities.
Mm.
So when you can close the educational disparity gap, you close the health disparities gap. People become health literate.
Uh-huh.
So I'm glad that we are where we are so that we're not chasing the medical model.
Right, right. We're starting to run short on time.
Okay.
We always conclude with two quick things.
Uh-huh.
So you've been a researcher for quite a while now. What is your favorite research story? The thing that happened that you said, wow, I'm glad, and it was either funny or, wow, I'm glad I'm in this business.
We were doing a behavioral and nutrition intervention with kids who had cystic fibrosis, and there was this little girl who hated coming to the hospital because every time she came, it was for treatment or she was hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
But our group sessions were in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into this little girl at a grocery store with her aunt. And she saw me and she ran up to me and hugged my legs and said, here's my doctor. And her aunt said, you don't look like the person that I knew as her pulmonologist. And I said, no, you know, I'm the psychotherapist. And she said, oh, you're the reason why she doesn't fear the hospital anymore.
Wow.
And I just wanted to cry.
Yeah.
If that's what it meant, that the little girl, she was 4 years old, that she's not afraid to go to the hospital anymore, that warmed my heart.
You had an impact.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
So speaking of impact, what's your take-home message? What do you want people to remember from this podcast?
From this podcast, I want them to remember that we all, as individuals, have a vested interest in each other's optimal health.
Mm.
That I can't be the best I can be if you're on the ground. And so together, we can raise all of us up high so that we can be the best we can be.
I like that take-home message, though.
I sound like a Marine.
Yeah. Everybody's health is our business.
It is.
It has to be.
It has to be.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've enjoyed having you. We'll have you back. We'll talk some more about health disparities research.
Okie dokie.
In the meantime, our audience is waiting with bated breath right now to hear the podcast question of the week. And with that question, we'll turn it over to Kelly, our producer.
What two disparities have a strong correlation with one another?
Great question. Be the first one to send us the correct answer via email at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of our nifty podcast T-shirts. It's never too late to enter. So even if you hear this, you know, in the middle of the week, next week or something like that, go ahead and send us the answer if you've got it. Again, I want to thank you all for taking the time to download us and being with us today. Lasako, thank you so much for being with us again.
Arigato gozaimasu.
You're welcome. And again, thank you all for taking the time to download us and be with us. We hope that you join us next week when we have another individual, an interesting individual from the world of sports medicine and health who will be with us. And by the way, we're progressing, ramping up towards our 100th podcast. We did the live podcast a couple weeks ago, but it's going to be rebroadcast on December the 21st. So make sure you set your calendars and hit the website for that. Both the video and the audio are up, by the way, so you can actually see what happened. And it was a fun, fun, fun podcast. So again, be with us next week. And until then, we hope that you have an active and healthy week.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.